Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
That's right. It is Monday, January 24th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report, broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Well, quite a weekend. We have a great show for you today. Professor Juan Cole will be here from the University of Michigan, longtime Majority Report Sam Cedar Show guest. I haven't talked to him. He was also on Cedar on Sundays. Haven't talked to him in a long time. He will be here to discuss with us both to give us a sense of what's happened and what's important about what's happened in Tunisia and, or is it Tunis? Well, Evan, I guess you don't know the answer to that. And he will also be telling us about these recently leaked, what some people are calling the Palestine Papers, about 1,600 documents that Al Jazeera has that basically reveal the inner workings of the peace process and apparently do not reflect very well on the Israelis, the Palestinian Authority, or the Americans. And we will talk to Professor Juan Cole about that later. Let's jump right in, folks, with, Friday night, heading up up to my place up in Columbia County, as we are wont to do, and I received just a bunch of text messages, some that were a little bit cryptic, some that weren't. You know, I don't really check it that much in the car unless I'm having a fight with my wife and she's driving and I want to ignore her and pretend like I'm doing work. And it was announced that after, at the end of Countdown, that this would be the last show for Keith Olbermann. And there, you know, I will get into this more during the post show because, you know, some of it's just sort of gossipy. But, and I should say that Evan, by the time Evan texted me, Evan's so the loop. My dad had already texted me. My dad already knew by the time I heard from Evan. So I should say that the long and short of it is, I do not believe this was a function of Comcast. And by that I mean, if this company was being taken over by, well, look, I think that Keith has not gotten along with management. And again, much of this is speculation. To the extent that I know anything that the public doesn't know, it's very little, and it's all essentially consistent with what with certain reports I've seen, because I'm not in regular contact with Keith Olbermann. We have no contact outside of the show, beyond my sending him a very brief email saying that I had a tremendous amount of respect and appreciation for all the work that he's done in the context of his show. That's it. And, you know, people used to think at Air America that, oh, you guys must all hang out in the commissary. And it just doesn't work that way. I would come in if I was on set, or if I wasn't, then I wouldn't have a chance. But I would say hello. We would talk. How's it going? Good. Sometimes Keith would talk about Bill Hicks because he knows I come from that world a little bit. And that's it. But, and frankly, there wasn't, when I would go in and subbing for him over the past month, there wasn't a lot of discussion about any meta aspects of the show. Beyond, you know, you can either sit here or there. Keith sometimes sits here, sometimes he sits there, you know, when you're prepping. And so, but through other channels, I hear things. And frankly, you know, I am trying to learn as I get older, and with only moderate success, to not articulate my opinion about things that aren't necessarily my business, don't necessarily mean anything to people outside of a narrow situation, and don't end up coming back and bite me in the ass. I think my ability to get myself in trouble is well documented. I am also not someone who has gotten along historically well with management. I don't know the management at MSNBC. I can tell you that the management at Air America, I don't believe it was appropriate for me to get along with them. But other people handled it differently and found more success in some instances than I did. But there was definitely tension between Olbermann and the management at MSNBC. And I think that they have been trying to fire him, get him to leave for an extended period of time. I would say probably, my guess is, for almost a year, maybe less. But that is the sense that I have gotten. I said that when they suspended him over the campaign donations, it seemed to me to be very much like the suspension of Randy Rhodes from Air America. A suspension that was meant as much to agitate, to set a pretext, as much as it was to carry out any policy dictates. And I think that, you know, frankly, I think they wanted to use that as a pretext at that time, and they couldn't figure out a way to make it happen. Because whatever, Scarborough had done the same thing, because everybody thought it was ridiculous. It didn't make any sense. Now, I do think that what is problematic is the great, and I will say this. I don't think, I don't know whether or not Keith wanted to leave that show, or if, to the extent that he did want to leave, it was a function of the grief he was taking from management. I don't know. I imagine it's somewhere in between. I don't know if he even knows how that breaks down. But I do think that we are going to be hearing from him shortly. I don't know, not here on this program. Evan's looking at me like, what? Were we supposed to answer a phone call? And I think that we are going to, you know, he's going to have a presence. And I think I don't need to tell you. Look, there are some people who, you know, would email me like, I never liked Keith anyway. It doesn't matter. Some people like him, dislike him from an entertainment perspective. Doesn't matter. I don't know. Maybe it's even so obvious it's not even worth saying, but Keith Olbermann brought a progressive infrastructure, helped the progressive infrastructure, brought a message of dissent to TV where there was none before then. You know, Donahue had a shot to roll up to the war. He was a very expensive show. Yes, he got good ratings on a crappy network. Do I think part of the reason why he was taken off was because he was anti-war? Yes. The other part was it was easy to justify because he was probably making more than he was earning in terms of the ratings. But Olbermann was not like that. Olbermann built MSNBC, both in terms of ratings and in terms of creating a programmatic structure for them. He is responsible for Rachel Maddow being on TV in the way that she is now. It's conceivable that Rachel, you know, Rachel could have, I don't know, been a contributor somewhere, but I don't see CNN giving her a show. And I don't think that MSNBC would have given her a show unless she was protected, promoted, championed as much by Keith Olbermann. And O'Donnell would not have a show. And Ed Schultz would not have a show. And Cenk Uygur would not be filling in. None of that would have happened. None of it. And Chris Hayes would not be as prominent as he is. And I could go down the line in terms of people who would have a much smaller platform were it not for what Keith Olbermann did. And, you know, we all have our parts that we play in this entire sort of movement to the extent that we have one. I don't think we quite have one yet, but an infrastructure. You know, people send me, you know, I can draw a line for you from, and I can't remember who it was, the person when I was doing Cedar on Sundays who sent me an email with guest selections to Melissa Harris Lacewell, I can't remember her new name, to being on my show, to her being on Rachel's show. I can draw a direct line, and it includes Jessica. And it includes my bookers who went on to these other shows. The first time that Chris Hayes, I think, did any media was on The Majority Report. The first time Marcos did any was on The Majority Report. I'm not saying this because I'm being self-aggrandizing, because no one cares. I'm saying this because that leads to something, and then that leads to something, and so on and so on and so on. So the implications of Keith Olbermann and what he did in those 8 years, I don't know if there was any policy implications that you could directly tie to it. We certainly didn't leave Iraq because he gave a special comment to Donald Rumsfeld. But the implications of his show will resonate. MSNBC could disappear tomorrow, and the implications of his show will resonate for years to come. And that's his importance. That's his legacy as of today. But the guy hasn't passed away. He's going to go on and do something else. And, you know, so it is a, it's a loss, but what he got in motion still exists. And, you know, I will talk about the implications of the new lineup and all that other stuff in the post show. But that's the most important thing. That's the biggest takeaway from this in terms of Olbermann, is that the ripples that he created over the course of those 8 years, 6 years, whatever it is, will be felt for a long time going forward. And I hope he's very proud about that. I'm sure he is. And I think to a certain extent, you know, it's as Joe Lieberman said, to everything there's a season. And I can't possibly win re-election. But Olbermann, you know, went out on top. Dude went out with the highest rated show on that program, consistently. Add up those two times he repeats, unbelievable. He created what, you know, one of the reasons why, the main reasons why I went into liberal talk radio, I mean, aside from my passion for politics, is I wanted to prove that you could make money as a liberal. It didn't exist in 2004. It didn't. There was nothing. Nobody. And now, it's different. It's different now. Not for me, but for others. All right, let's take a break. We're going to go and speak to Professor Juan Cole. Very excited to talk to him about the situation in Tunisia. And I will talk more about Keith Olbermann, Countdown, all that good stuff in the post show. We'll be right back in just a moment. All right, we are back. This is the Majority Report. I am Sam Cedar. On the phone, one of our very early guests on Majority Report 1, as we like to call it around here, Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. He is the author of Engaging the Muslim World and Napoleon's Egypt, and blogs at juancole.com. Also known as Informed Comment. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thanks so much, Sam.
So I wanted to have you on to discuss two things. One, give us an update and an overview of what is happening in Tunisia. Two, to ask you, is it Tunisia or Tunis? And three, to ask you to talk to you about these Palestine papers. But first, give us an update on what's happening with this, I guess, this revolution.
Well, the revolution, of course, overthrew the president a week and a half ago. He fled from the country. And then the question was, what comes next? And the Tunisian elite, the party to which the president belonged, tried to follow the constitution. After some negotiation about which part of the Constitution to follow, they decided that the Speaker of the House becomes the President when the President is incapacitated, vacates office, and then he appoints a Prime Minister. The problem is that the Speaker of the Parliament is an old stalwart of the President's party, and then he appointed as Prime Minister the same Prime Minister that was there under the deposed president.
Let me back up for a moment, because I think to a certain extent, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was the tremendous lack of coverage that this has received in this country. And so let's back up just a little bit. And if you could tell us how we got to this point, because we had was Ben Ali a dictator? What were the conditions that led to this revolution?
The Tunisians had been colonized by the French, and they in 1881, and they lived under French rule until 1956. And one of the ways they got out from under French rule after World War II was that a party had grown up in Tunisia called the Rally for Constitutional Democracy. RCD. Well, it's now called that. It was called something else. That was the New Constitutional Party originally, and it was led by a man named Habib Bourguiba, who was one of those, you know, decolonizing leaders who brought the country to independence and then was lionized and set up a kind of, you know, one party state. And it was a nanny state. It took care of people and in some ways continued some colonial policies. And then Bourguiba got more and more decrepit and finally was deposed in the late 80s by his vice president, Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali. And Ben Ali continued the dictatorial ways of Bourguiba, but made them much worse. He married a kind of social climber, and she had very greedy relatives. And he turned everything over to his relatives and her relatives, and they just, like, looted the country. They used the banks for their own purposes. They were very corrupt. They demanded bribes from everybody. They usurped businesses at will. They kind of acted like a mafia family, but they were the government. So it was everywhere. It was inescapable. It was oppressive. It was suffocating. And finally, people just rose up against it and got rid of it.
And so this was, it was predicated too, or I guess the catalyst for this was essentially a guy who, couldn't find work, had a family, had an apple cart, a fruit cart, was prevented from doing it because he didn't pay a certain permit and basically lit himself on fire. Is that right?
That's right. Well, the man was a college graduate. He was an educated person who couldn't get a proper job, and 20% of the educated, the college educated in Tunisia are unemployed. And so he turned to the marginal economy. He turned to, as you say, peddling vegetables and fruit. But obviously the police tried to shake him down. You know, everything requires a bribe. They called it a permit. And they took away his cart. So he went to the office and complained, and they slapped him and humiliated him and sent him away. So this is a person who should be, like, running an office or doing white-collar work, and he can't even make a living selling cauliflower. So he was so frustrated, he set himself on fire as a protest. He died. But there were so many people in Tunisia who knew exactly where he was coming from that they started coming out into the streets and protesting, especially initially in the rural areas, and then they moved towards the capital, and the movement just caught on fire. That's not a pun.
Now the interesting thing about this, or some have speculated, that the reason why this hasn't gotten the same amount of attention as maybe is maybe another one. I don't know if there's any oil deposits there.
No oil.
And that's probably a good reason why we don't pay as much attention to it as we would other countries. And it's considered to be in the Arab world, is it not?
It's an Arabic-speaking country, so it is in the Arab world. North Africa, you know, is a little bit isolated from the Eastern Arab world,
right.
So it has its own history. It was dominated by France, but then so was Syria. Sam, one of the reasons it wasn't covered is, frankly, that corporate news in the United States, and it wasn't covered on television, of course, print news covered it, but it wasn't covered on television or a lot of radio because the corporations that own news in the United States and use news for profit have decided that they want big profits. They want 33% on their money. And they've closed all the bureaus. So there used to be like a Cairo bureau for CBS News or NBC News. You could fly over from Cairo to Tunis pretty easily. But now they've closed all the bureaus. Some of them just report on the Middle East from Europe. Some of them have a few Jerusalem bureaus, but Jerusalem, you know, is isolated from the Middle East. It's in Israel, and it's even hard. You can't travel from there to a lot of the Middle East. So it's just a corporate decision that they're going to make money on news. They're not going to spend a lot of money gathering the news. And so then you're going to hear endlessly about facilitated.
Well, do you think that if this was a revolution that was instigated by extreme or by religion, I should say, in other words, if this was a Islamic revolution, that we would hear more of it? I mean, I guess to a certain extent, I mean, I don't think that there is a concerted effort not to report on this. I think, as you say, it's simply a function of there not being the resources there used to be. But at the same time, I also think that it doesn't fit necessarily into a narrative that the media loves to trumpet. I mean, this is a revolution which, at least as far as I can tell, is fairly rare in this part of the world where you have a the a dictator deposed from what seems to be purely economic justice reasons, for purely economic justice reasons.
That's right. There had been a Muslim fundamentalist party in Tunisia, the Nahda, or Renaissance Party of Rashid Ghannouchi. The government, being a dictatorship and a secular-leaning dictatorship, had destroyed that party, dismantled it. And so it didn't play a really prominent role in this revolution. It was a revolution of workers and the unemployed, and then kind of the white-collar middle class who was tired of censorship and government oppression. So, yeah, if it had been an Islamic revolution, it might have gotten more play. And by the way, there were some corporate news reporters who got there. Ben Wedemann of CNN heroically got to Tunis on Saturday, just after the president had fled. And he must have been sending reports to CNN, but I never saw any of them on air. It means the producers decided this is not a story.
Yeah, and now, to what extent is it possible? Because my sense, to the extent that you can make it overgeneralize in the dynamic in the Middle East, at least, and maybe less so in for countries in North Africa, particularly ones that don't have oil deposits. But my sense has always been that, to a certain extent, to the extent that there are despotic leaders in some of these countries in that world, what they've been able to do is to change the nature of the of how people perceive the problem with the regime, as opposed to the problem being one of living under a dictatorship and one that isn't necessarily providing economic benefits to the vast majority of people. There's a turning or a repackaging of this as a problem with religion and an attempt to use sort of religious fundamentalism and America as the bad guy as a way of deflecting anger towards these dictators.
Well, that's certainly been the strategy of Ben Ali since 2001. Actually, the Tunisian elite has always been very good at positioning itself on geopolitics. So back in the Cold War in the 50s and 60s and 70s, Bourguiba represented Tunisia as, pro-Western and, was mildly socialist, but it was anti-Soviet. So the U.S. And Tunisia had pretty good relations in the Cold War. And then after the Cold War ended in the 90s, and Ben Ali had come to power, the U.S. didn't really have that much to do with Tunisia. But then after 2001, the relationship was reestablished. It wasn't really, really cozy, but the United States was giving the Tunisian secret police training and the military training, and giving Ben Ali some money. And it was because he represented himself, as all that stood between civilization and the barbarous Al Qaeda hordes of the Sahara.
And do you think that the dynamic that took place in Tunisia is one that could spread to other countries in that area, or do you think there's going to be a fairly isolated revolution?
Well, it already has spread to some extent. There have been big demonstrations in Jordan and in Yemen. I say big in the sense of, 2,000-3,000 people, and Sudan. And there have been also other instances of self-immolation. There have been people who've set themselves on fire in protest in Algeria, Egypt, Mauritania, even one in Saudi Arabia. The idea that the revolution would unfold in exactly the same way somewhere else is a little far-fetched, because this was not a revolution that was led by anybody. It didn't seem to have a strong organizational or ideological base, and so it was spontaneous, and it was local networks that got it up. Facebook and Twitter were important to the educated middle class, but in the rural areas, it would have been, you know, worker networks that were more important, or kinship networks. So I don't know. I don't think that it's easy to see exactly the same kind of thing happening elsewhere. Moreover, you know, Tunisia is a little bit unique. It doesn't have a strong ethnic divide. So people weren't afraid that if they got rid of the president that some alternative ethnic group would grab power. Whereas in Jordan, you have a conflict between the East Bank Palestinians and the West Bank Palestinians. In Syria, you have a conflict between the majority Sunnis and the religious minorities. Everywhere you go, you know, there's some division that makes it hard for people to unite around a cause like that. Then the army in Tunisia stepped aside. It refused to fire on the protesters for the president and kind of let the president know that. And I think that's one of the reasons he fled. Whereas, you know, we've already seen in Jordan there was a civil war in 1970-71 where the army killed 10,000 Palestinians who had risen up against the King Hussein. So, you know, in other places, the willingness of the army to shoot is not in doubt.
All right. Well, you know, let's turn for a moment because I want to get your take on this. And we're obviously this story is just broken over the past couple of days. And so I think people are beginning to absorb this more. But there was about 1,600 documents that have been published via The Guardian and Al Jazeera, or at least have, I guess, been revealed or in some way reported on, that seem to be documents. Now, tell us what these documents are. I'm not even quite clear exactly what where these documents came from.
Right. Well, it appears to be that they came from a unit of the Palestine Liberation Organization, or the Palestine Authority, that was responsible for negotiating with the Israelis. And especially the office of negotiator Saab Erekat, who was an old right-hand man of Yasser Arafat. And somebody in those offices was unhappy with the concessions that were being made by the PLO demeanor of the negotiators with regard to Israeli intransigence. And so they leaked the 1,600 documents to Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera did its best to authenticate them, had some success in doing so, and then shared them with The Guardian in the UK, and they also authenticated them. So I think they just put them up. It's not like WikiLeaks that they're dribbling them out, and they put them up with a search engine.
Now,
They've started to report on the substance of these documents.
The documents, in terms of time, span from when to when?
1999 to the present.
Okay, and so my understanding is that the first sort of first blush, these documents show that the Palestinian Authority was basically willing to make virtually any concession to the Israelis, and that the Israelis have been following have been very disingenuous in this peace process. Is that an accurate assessment of what we know so far from these documents?
Yeah, the documents reveal that there was no peace process, that the Israelis were never interested in agreeing to anything, including very generous, by all lights, very generous offers from the PLO. From the Palestine Authority, I mean to say, and that the Palestine Authority officials were giving away everything. Erekat went to Ariel Sharon when he was prime minister, and Tzipi Livni, and he said, "We want a state. We want it to have sovereignty." And they said, "Well, you understand, you can't have an army, an air force, or a navy." And Erekat, after a couple of years, said, "Well, I understand. We can't have an army, an air force, or a navy. So there's no sovereignty in this thing that's being called a state." And then the Israelis keep expanding their colonies in the district they created of Jerusalem, which includes part of the Palestinian West Bank. Arakat offered them most of Jerusalem. He said, you can have the big Yerushalayim, which is the Hebrew for Jerusalem. Well, the other Palestinians think that East Jerusalem should be Palestinian and should be the capital of Palestine. So Arakat was just giving it away. And the Israelis wouldn't take it. They said, no, we want the whole thing. We're not going to take part of it. And even, you know, Zippy Livni is said to have told him at one time, when he made a very generous offer, she said, well, I know this must have been hard for you to do, so we appreciate the gesture, but no, it's not enough.
Yeah, and as the days progress, we're gonna hear more of the specifics from this. But this is, it seems to me, basically says that there has been no peace process for the past 10 to 20 years. That it's all
That's
been
right.
more or less a charade, a charade.
Yes, yes, I think certainly since Ehud Barak went out of office, because I think Barak was the last prime minister who genuinely tried in 1999 and 2000. But once Ariel Sharon came in, then I think from that point onward, there has been no peace process. And Zippy Livni, in one of these, she's a former foreign minister in Israel, in one of these admits that the Israeli tactic was to pretend to engage in negotiations while assiduously colonizing the Palestinian West Bank, on the grounds that eventually they put so much people in there that a state would become impossible. And
right.
then they could turn around and tell the Palestinians, well, you can't have a state because we've got all these Israelis living there and we can't move them. So she admitted in one of these documents that was official Israeli policy. They were accused of doing this by outsiders because you could see them doing it,
right.
but they always denied it. But she admitted it.
I mean, this is fascinating, and it's going to. It's been great to talk to you about it, and I would love to have you back in a couple of weeks when we get a better sense of just when people have had the opportunity to comb through these documents and to see what the implications of this are. Because I imagine this is going to bode very poorly for the Palestinian Authority, and I think it's going to have. I mean. I don't know what the implications are going to be in Israel, in the Israeli body politic at this point, because it doesn't seem like there has been a any type of movement on the political side of wanting to really make peace in Israel. And it sounds like this is going to perhaps further entrench interests on both sides, or I don't know. I mean, what would you predict we're going to see? And then maybe we'll have you back in some time to see if you had the right sense.
Well, I think the credibility of the PLO, the Fatah organization in particular, of Mahmoud Abbas, in which the United States and Israel have invested a lot of credibility, the credibility of that organization, which runs the Palestine Authority, with the Palestinian street will be mud after this. So I think it's very very hard for Arakat and Mahmoud Abbas to come back from this. They're denying it all, but I think people will understand what's going on. And then, you know, I hope that it will help to revive the Israeli peace movement, because there's been a really strong and important Israeli peace movement at some points in the country's history, which declined radically when Hamas started blowing up their kids. And now that there has been a period of relative calm, you know, it's come back. So just a week and a half ago, there was a big demonstration in Tel Aviv in which Israelis unfurled Palestinian flags and demanded that there be a genuine peace process. So these leaks could, I think, strengthen the Israeli left. At least I hope so.
Well, it'll be interesting. I hope that you're correct in that assessment. Professor Juan Cole, blogs at juancole.com, informed comment, author of Engaging the Muslim World and Napoleon's Egypt. I've read both those books, ladies and gentlemen, and I highly recommend them. Professor, thank you so much for joining me.
It's always great to be on with you, Sam. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. That's all the time we have for today's show. That interview went on for a long time, but he's a very interesting guy, very well-spoken. I've always enjoyed talking to him, and these are things that are important, and one can only hope this has good implications for the peace process. I don't know if it does, but I will take your IMs on the other side of this quick break. I want to remind you, please become a Majority Report member. You know all the benefits that's involved in this. And when on the other side, I'm going to talk about the MSNBC lineup. Try to not burn any bridges and explain to you why this show becomes even more important than it was just yesterday. Well, yesterday was a weekend. And also, Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Every time you buy coffee, tea, chocolate, and get 10% off by using the coupon code MAJORITY, you help this program. And you get great coffee. And you promote fair trade. And you promote a co-op business. What more could you want? That's like a five-fer, six-fer in radio parlance. All right, folks, stick around. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be right back. All right, we're back for the Majority Report post-show. Did you see the, Dorsey, did you see the logo?
No.
Avant tweeted a logo that David wrote for the, created for the Majority Report post-show. I may have to come up with a better name for it. My old buddy TW suggested After Party. But, and I like, it's sort of, I don't know if he meant it this way, it's sort of a double entendre.
I don't know. I think it's promising too much, like a party.
Well, but maybe it's after party as in like post-partisan.
Oh.
And not post-partisan like Obama post-partisan, but like post-partisan in terms of, I didn't even get to any of the stuff, the reports on the State of the Union address. There's pre-reports, and the reports now, that it sounds like Obama's going to back off of endorsing Social Security cuts. It sounds like that. Keep your fingers crossed. If it's true, folks, we'll talk more about this tomorrow in our lead up to this, the State of the Union. If it's true, understand that this is a victory for progressives. It's sad that we had to try and regain ground that we already had, frankly. But if you think that this decision was not a function of concerted efforts to protect Social Security, of people saying that this is going to destroy the Democratic Party, of those pollsters coming out and arguing their data in such a way that this would destroy the Democratic Party. You know, when you're a pollster, you can interpret numbers any way you want. 70% of the American population does not want, 80% of the American population does not want Social Security cut. And you can come out and you can say, well, you know, what they just need is leadership to understand why it needs to be cut. Or you can say, if you do this, you're destroying the Democratic Party. And I think there's a reason why what we heard was, if you do this, we're going to destroy the Democratic Party, is because, you know, when you talk 80% of the American public, obviously that includes a significant amount who are not Democrats. But it was, I think, reactions from people. There were thousands of signatures on petitions, and just, I think, knock on wood, if it's the case that it doesn't come up in the State of the Union, it's a victory. And then we just have to make sure it doesn't come up again. So we'll see. I will be very happy, very pleased. Clearly was on the table because they said it was on the table. That's how I know it was on the table. This story about Beck, too. Oh, we didn't even play that Tunisian protest thing. Audio. We didn't have time. But you know what? He was better. He was better.
Yep.
You know, Glenn Beck is assaulting. This is just crazy shit. And Beck is just so out of control. It's unbelievable. And I actually think he's starting to get more insane because he sees his ratings dropping. Like, I thought... And he seems to be flailing around. He sort of like goes back and forth between this, like, I'm going to become the next Dr. Phil Oprah with my E4. Which I still don't know what the fuck that is. E4. Education, I'm an enigma, egomania. What else is it?
That's my favorite clip when he's saying that to the crowd and he's asking if everyone gets it, and there's just this slow wave
of
blank faces.
Just like, are you getting this? Because, you know, like, you know, the director, you can see this on Media Matters. The director of the show is just like, oh, hey, Jimmy, watch this. I'm going to fucking take this long shot of the audience. Ah, look at the faces! Ah! Is he going to see this cut? Don't worry about it, dude. He doesn't watch the cut. Are you kidding? Look at the guy. Because it's just like an audience. We're just sitting there looking like, what?
Do we have anything under our seats?
And so now he's attacking the 72-year-old professor, this woman who, because of a piece that she wrote with her husband in 1966, she is a professor at, like, where is this? She's now a professor at the City University of New York, and he claims that she is responsible for the destruction of our economy. She is fundamentally responsible for the unsustainability and possible collapse of our economic system. You know, sometimes you forget. There's some things in your process on a daily basis. So let me repeat that. According to Beck, she is responsible for the potential economic collapse.
What are you talking about?
And I use my daughter's voice in that instance because he's like a child. Like a child who's an idiot. He's like an idiotic child. It's like an idiotic child who stumbled upon, like, oh, look at this loaded gun. Yeah! And he's waving it around, and he's like, I'm an idiot. Hey, look at me. And he poops his pants, and he's still got the gun. And everybody's like, Glenn, put the gun down. Let me change your pants. Nah, shut up. That's what he's like. Countdown until... That guy on Twitter is like, Sam, I heard you use a gun noise on your show today. Just that irresponsible rhetoric. Just unbelievable. She's getting death threats now. The 72-year-old woman. Guys posing as students came in to interview her, that, you know, because they wanted to put her up on the Blaze or something like that. And now she's terrified. And I would be, too. She's a 72-year-old lady. And she's getting death threats now. Because she's solely responsible. Because of an article she wrote in 1966 in The Nation magazine. For the economic collapse. How stupid are these people? How completely stupid are these people? Do they think that the linchpin of our financial system is a 72-year-old woman who teaches at City College? It's just unbelievable what you can do with a complete lack of shame, an absence of that part of brain that basically says, like, I don't give a shit about anything other than what's going to, in some way, enrich me and get me attention. And a constant source of moronic followers that are available to you if you're on Fox News. It's shocking. And, you know, this brings up another aspect of what was so valuable about Keith Olbermann. You know, right now, it's second nature to be aware of that Glenn Beck is ranting and raving like a lunatic. And that, you know, Bill O'Reilly, you know, talks about loofahs and, you know, harasses his producers. Or that Rush Limbaugh, you know, who is a hillbilly heroin addict, recovered, supposedly, and needs to pop, you know, Viagra when he goes on his, you know, his trips to the Dominican. You know, going on and, you know, the most offensive thing about Rush Limbaugh with his ching chong chow is that he thought it was funny. I mean, yes, my five-year-old daughter would think it was funny, but not if she understood in the context of it making fun of the way that Chinese people speak. She would just think the noises are funny. But if she actually had the level of consciousness that, like, someone who's, like, 20 might have, or 30, as opposed to being 5, she might go, like, wow, that's really retarded. Keith Olbermann was the first person to bring this stuff to TV. You know, to cover this stuff. We did it on radio. Al Franken did it in his books and on radio. Media Matters, which started in, I think, 2004. Maybe a little bit later. Started to do it online. But the bottom line is, you know, what we all take for granted now, that it's a funny bit to mock these right-wingers. You know, it took a lot of, became part of the social fabric from Olbermann. And, you know, you see things like Fox News becoming the, now, the most distrusted network in news. It takes a while, but he contributed heavily to that. And, you know, frankly, I had heard rumors for a long time that there was instability with his relationship with that show. I mean, if you read certain areas, you could see that. And I heard it from other quarters, people who... I know a lot of people at NBC Universal through coincidence and my days in entertainment. Let's put it that way. So I would hear a lot of things that were sort of like within their corporate culture, but not necessarily direct. And there was speculation that O'Donnell was an insurance policy at 10 p.m. You know, for this type of thing, because he had done very well in Countdowns, and you know, as hosting Countdown. But you know, when he hosted Countdown, he was doing Keith Olbermann. When I host a Countdown, I'm doing Keith Olbermann, because he show was built around him. You know, everything from the sort of just the grammatical structure, and you know, when we started this show. I think I spent the first couple of weeks of this show talking about O'Donnell, because his show started right around the same time. And, you know, I'm not convinced that some of that hasn't gotten back to him. I wouldn't take it personally, but other people do sometimes. And, you know, Lawrence and I had a good... relationship when he would come on to the Sam Cedar show, onto the Majority Report, onto Cedar on Sundays, as a fairly frequent guest, you know, more so after Al left, because he would go on Al's show a lot. But certainly during the Majority Report, because, you know, Janine was doing West Wing, which he was executive producing at that time. And I would kid O'Donnell as being the voice of the establishment. Because he does like to, you know, he considers, I think it's, you know, considers his politics to be democratic socialist in the European mold. I'm not familiar enough with that spectrum in Europe to know exactly what that even means, per se. But it sounds like something I would like. But I think one of the defining factors of Lawrence's worldview is that of an insider. And I think he has some appreciation for voices outside of that. You know, I've seen some big outsider voices on his program. But in the final analysis, that's his perspective on things. And plus, his show is geared for 10 p.m. I mean, I don't know if they're going to call it The Last Word, but it's going to be awkward. Well, I guess it won't be. I mean, I always interpreted The Last Word because it was the last show on their schedule. And, you know, you can still have, I guess, The Last Word. But it's going to be like, and that's The Last Word. And now Rachel Maddow.
And Ed Schultz.
And Ed Schultz. So it's going to be interesting to see if that show works there. Very well may. It's going to be interesting to see if Ed's show works after Rachel's. Those are two very different types of shows. And, Ed's more bombastic. Ed's more like a radio guy. So in many respects, sort of like me. I am now more partial to vodka than I think beer. But aside from that. And so, you know, who knows what's going to happen with that schedule? But I hope that it does well. Because I want them to continue to making money using voices that are left to center. I would like voices, the thing that I love about Rachel's voice is that it is both an outsider voice and a liberal voice. You know, there was a fascinating post that was up like a week or two ago by Freddie DeBoer. What site was that on? It's not one that I'd normally go to that often. I can't remember off the top of my head. And maybe we'll have him on to discuss it, because he talks about how there really is no real hard left in the long tail, short tail, I don't know how you describe this, amongst the biggest blogs, let's put it that way. Amongst the biggest blogs, there is no extreme left. There are people who are liberal and have extreme rhetoric. You know, he said, like Jane Hampshire. He said, but he was taking on you guys like Iglesias and Ezra Klein, who I've always perceived to be center-left at best. And certainly inside-out guys, establishment people. It's an interesting post. Maybe we'll talk about that. But I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind here, because that's also what we're seeing in the context of the Obama administration. I mean, I think Obama's politics are center-left, but not when it comes to Fran Lebowitz always used to say, the problem with liberals is money. And I think you could call Barack Obama a liberal, but you would have to have an understanding that he is, in terms of the means in which, to the extent that he wants to in any way provide for some income redistribution in this country, He wants to do it like Republicans of old wanted to do it. It was just a matter of, like, how much should we contribute to these different programs? How much should we support those who are poor? Republicans would say just enough to maintain social stability. We don't want Detroit to burn anymore. Or we don't care about Detroit anymore. We don't want Larchmont to burn anymore. To burn at all. And that is really, the issue is just how much are we allowing the Beltway wisdom and the establishment to rule the day, to rule our political discourse. And, you know, people give shit to Olbermann from coming to sports. Good. Are you kidding me? As opposed to what? As opposed to what? Okay, I understand. Scarborough was a congressman. So what? So wasn't Cher. So wasn't Sonny Bono. Maybe he was a good congressman. I don't know. But, I mean, there's a lot of idiots who are congressmen.
Who's that guy with the awesome wig? The toupee?
Oh, yeah. Traficant?
Traficant.
You know, at the end of the day, you can learn about politics by just reading a lot. And, I mean, I was a government major. I served my interns, my internships. I don't know. Right, Nefertiti weighs in. Tom DeLay was a bug exterminator. Good. He was good. We had an outside voice. I can't wait to see what he does next, frankly. I hope it's big, and I hope it involves syndicating web radio shows. Like mine. Okay, let's go to the IMs, shall we, people? War on the poor. Tunis is the capital of Tunisia. Yes, okay. I guess Professor Cole might have thought that I was joking about that.
Yeah, I was confused.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. Tunisia is the country. Tunis is the capital city. Yep, your ability to shoot yourself in the foot is well documented, at least with us, says Morella. So far, you've been winning your jihad, referring to the Social Security thing. Kenny Mack, in reference to that independent at diner. Okay. This is the guy I had dinner with that I've been talking about. That had a problem with your tone. I've had the same argument many times while bartending. I always say smugness and snark exist on both sides of the aisle. The difference being the left uses it to enhance the facts through intelligent debate. The right uses it as a replacement for facts and intelligent debate. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Perfect example, Charles Krauthammer and Monica Crowley. That's exactly right. And, you know, to the extent that people would equate Olbermann with anybody on Fox, Olbermann had rhetoric that may have been similar, but was founded in facts. But yes, he was in the same business. It's just that you could believe the facts he was saying. He didn't make things up from whole cloth. He wasn't shilling for corporate interests. And, you know, I say this, it's a partial defense of myself, too. I mean, I like to think of myself as someone who is using a similar vehicle as the right, but I'm delivering fundamentally and objectively and sourced facts. There is a difference. I mean, you can listen to right-wing talk radio, and they will reference things, but they will not source things. They just simply won't. They simply won't. All of their information comes from pre-digested sources. Which is why you see so many times in the right-wing echo chambers so many times where they'll make such ghastly mistakes. Because nobody does their work. They don't have to. You're not rewarded in right-wing circles for things like accuracy or soundness. You're rewarded for scalps. You're rewarded for hits on your webpage. You're rewarded for how much of a splash you can make. That's just the fact. It just doesn't work that way on the left. I mean, do you think that Olbermann was embraced by the establishment left in the way that Hannity has been embraced by the establishment right? I mean, Dick Cheney would go on Hannity for interviews. I think Bush, right, did interviews with Hannity. Do you think anyone on the left would do that with Keith Olbermann? Can you find me one well-known conservative commentator or writer who has disparaged or sloughs off Limbaugh or Hannity or Levin? With the frequency in which the same happened on the left in terms of Olbermann? No. You can't. Because the left has a different... equation, I guess. In reference to that independent diner, blah, blah, okay. Zach Punk. I much prefer listening to your internet stream than watching you fill in for Keith. When you fill in for Keith, it feels like there's someone in full military garb standing off camera. Just face forward and read the teleprompter and no one will get hurt. Keith is obviously someone who has a problem with structure, a problem with authority. This goes back in his career. I understand this. I even respect that he lives in a world now where he doesn't need to be part of a billion-dollar network. He can go off on his own and be the person he really wants to be. I'm not sad at all about this. I'm very excited to see what he does next. I do, too. My guess is that he will have to stay off television anywhere from 6 to 12 months. You know, there was a negotiation. He had a two-year contract. They went in. I don't know the details of this. I'm speculating because I've been in situations like this. If there was a negotiation, that means that they said, we'll give you X number on the dollar, 75 cents on the dollar of what we owe you, 80 cents on the dollar of what we owe you, 60 cents on the dollar of what we owe you, and we will knock off X amount of time in terms of your exclusivity, and we will allow you, you can have internet and you can have radio. You can keep this segment or that segment. That's the way it will work. And so he's not, you know, his contract was up to 2 years. I would imagine they got that at least halved in terms of when he can be on air. And I don't know if he will. Look, the options are this. He could go to CNN. I'm not sure. I tend to doubt it. I don't know why he would. Other than he could go to CNN and immediately be the highest-rated program in primetime. And that's alluring. That's a very alluring thing. I don't know that CNN wants to change their brand in that way. They might. You know, I'll tell you something. I would watch Olbermann for an hour and then Spitzer for an hour. Spitzer is a very smart guy. I love his interviews. He likes to take it to them. I don't know how long the structure of that show is going to last, but I would watch that. I would watch that. I don't know if that suits Olbermann very well, though. Here's another thing you could do. Syndication. you know, there's a lot of syndicating companies out there. A 7 o'clock, 7 p.m. syndication deal where he's doing his show at 7 p.m. with DVRing and whatnot. There's a lot of syndicators out there who would love that type of... And you know what? Through a syndication deal, he might actually be able to get more clearance than he got on MSNBC. And frankly, probably better positioning on the dial. That's a possibility. You know, Adam Carolla, when he left his morning show to do a podcast, he had something like 300,000 downloads. On a daily basis, I think. I'm not sure what the numbers are now. How many people would go and watch an Olbermann, you know, podcast or listen to an Olbermann podcast? I bet you a lot. And he waits a year or two, you know. How long before we, you know, somebody sent me an email about this, and he was correct. I don't have the resources to do this right now. But how long until we are consuming our media all on demand? And once it's all on demand, it really doesn't matter if you get it from MSNBC or you get it from somewhere else. Or, you know, Hulu, which gives you movies on demand. Or Netflix, which lets you watch TV on demand. Or iTunes. You know, so.
You know, he could always go to Headline News.
He could go to Headline News.
That would be, I mean, there's not really a filter on Nancy Grace or even Joy Behar, you know?
That's true.
And they don't have, it looks like from 6, 7, until Nancy Grace comes on at 8, there's not much going on, you know? He would be perfect to put against Matthews. He would take down Matthews pretty hard, I bet.
I think that he's got a lot of options, and but my sense is that he's already got a plan. But who knows? Who knows what kind of opportunities will arise? I really appreciate it. And remember, he had 300,000 people sign a petition. Mm. I appreciate O'Donnell's insider perspective. It's interesting and valid. I think he's always fair. And unlike Olbermann, he's better at bringing other points of view and engaging people in tough debate. That's not meant to be a knock at Olbermann. I'm just pointing out they have a different style, different strength. I agree with that. Absolutely. And I would argue at times, for me personally, because I do all the stories that Olbermann... You know, it's like... when I watch Olbermann's show, I'm like, I know. I read that piece. Yeah, I read that. Yeah, I interviewed that. I know that. The reason why I had to stop watching O'Donnell is because I would watch that show. I get so agitated. But I like that feeling of agitation. That is a psychological problem I have. So now that it's 8 p.m., I'll be able to sleep better. But let me say this. I'm not the typical consumer of this. Because I do this as a living. O'Donnell had the ability to bring on Levi Johnson at 10 p.m. and have it be an interview. Because, from my perspective, he didn't have the weight of having to deliver the other half a dozen stories that would be more important to me that I saw on Olbermann's show or on Maddow's show. It's a different dynamic now. He's not batting cleanup. You know, his job is to get on first base and second base. It'll be interesting. Superfunk 72. Yo, Sammy, great show. You really think the media overemphasizes the threat of radical Islam? Are you serious? Or are you being facetious? I'm gonna guess you're joking. I'm gonna give you that credit, Superfunk. Serious? Yes, I do. I do not believe that there is an existential threat to this country from radical Islam. I do not think that Islam, that we are in any danger of Sharia law in this country. I do not think that there is a problem that building a Muslim community center two blocks away from Ground Zero is a function of terrorist attacks. Do I think there's a danger of terrorist attacks? Yes, I do. I think more people will die in any given five-year period from smoking, cars, food poisoning. I don't know. Many, many other potential life-threatening things. And terrorist attacks are more random in some respects, I guess, although not really. I mean, is a car accident random or not? But I do not think there's an existential threat. And I think that that gets lost. I mean, I know this, that it basically was the it was the linchpin to leading this country into a completely unjust and unnecessary war in Iraq that killed 100,000 people. Cranes are flying. And if we buy Marin's WTF one, that's be like a 7-fer. Yes, that's actually a good point. If you go to now, we that's why we've got to get a brand. I want to beat Marin in something. Soon I'll have his microphone. Not his, per se, but the same type of microphone.
We don't know. It could be his.
It could be his. Maybe Marin send me his microphone. Maybe Marin secretly is doing me a solid. Optimal tomatoes. Majority report afterglow. Any chance Olbermann goes into politics? I doubt it. Although, I doubt it. I mean, I guess, but I doubt it. Good morning, Sam. How about David Sirota as a guest? He has tons of respect for you and is hawking a book. Why are you laughing, Dorsey?
I was reading something online that made me laugh.
Dorsey pointed out once to me that something that I had tweeted showed up on Sirota's Facebook. Slightly
is being generous.
Slightly changed and on his Facebook post as if it was his. That doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't. Just got the first book review, Back to the Future. It's from Kirkus, which panned my last book. And it's a review. Oh, this is Sirota. The best review of anything I've ever written. I'll post the full review when it's online, but the key excerpt is Kirkus calling it a sharp, dizzying history lesson that packs a punch. The consistently ever-essence text. It's cathartic and socially significant. Yeah, if David sends me a book, I will read it and I'll have him on. Of course. Of course I will. How long do you think Keith needs to stay out with the non-compete clause that usually happens on these things? Do you think the management problems were with GE being afraid of Fox retaliation since Keith gave him such a bad time? I already addressed the non-compete. Look, I from what I've heard, he was protected there by Jeff. What was the head of NBC? Dorsey. I'm not going to ask.
Zucker,
yeah. Now, Evan's like, I don't know. What's NBC? I think he was protected by Jeff Zucker. And if Zucker, you know, I think, I just don't think that there was an issue with GE. Maybe they would complain about him sometimes, which would have given the latitude. But look, at the end of the day, it's the management of MSNBC and the pressure from NBC News. And, you know, I personally, I don't understand, and I've never understood, how you can want to fire your top-rated guy. I mean, everything else aside, I know that people can be difficult. I worked with Gary Busey for 3 months as his director for 4 months. Do you understand? Do you understand that I have a crease that runs from just below my left eyebrow that will go up to here that I get when I'm stressed? That was developed because I would wake up in the morning when I was living in L.A. working with Gary Busey, and I would have this line just because I had spent the whole night sleeping frowning. My hair turned gray and then came back to its normal color after. I swear to God. And then the gray I have now is a function of working with Marin. When I started in October of 2008, when I started with Marin, he said to me, "Do you dye your hair?" And I said, "No. Why?" And he goes, "Carl thinks you dye your hair." I'm like, "No, I don't dye my hair. You can see I have one or two grays here." And I swear to you, 6 months later, I'm like salt and pepper. And I don't know if that was him like putting some type of curse on me when he asked me that question, or because he said that, then like, you know, all my stress went into like, Jimmy Reefer Cake. Look at him. Look at, I can just, I haven't even read it, but I can see that, that Jimmy is like just sort of basking in the glow of, "Glad you guys like the songs, Chris Rose and Reefer Cake got more cooking for you." All right, buddy. You know, just pace yourself. I celebrated by ordering some Just Coffee Revolutionary Blend. Booyah. Nice. It's great to see right-wing assholes mocked and ridiculed. You were right. We take that for granted nowadays. The only downfall is you end up with a lot of echo chamber effect. You end up with free publicity for Limbaugh. The SNL skit with Keith impression was some of the funniest shit ever. Dude, that would be great if he went to CNN. Keith was so passionate on healthcare issues. I hope he keeps at it. Me too. Dradmanthes. Signed up for Ring of Fire this year to hear some of your great interviews. Well worth it. I was glad you interviewed Nywert. I think it's important to point out the difference between you personally saying something like, "Let's hold their feet to the fire," and Sarah Palin's "Don't retreat, reload" revolves around the definition of violent rhetoric itself. Rhetoric involves how a message is received by its intended audience. I tried to tell that to the Twitter guy we had on, and he was just like, what was he like? What was he like? He was just like,
"Mom! Mom! Mom! Why did you do that to me?"
Well, he wasn't exactly like that, but I think you get the point. No, I don't know if there was a point, actually, now that I think about that. Rhetoric, okay, there's no responsible expectation that the majority reporters are going to literally torture Obama with fire. Right. But Palin is expected, as part of a gun culture where people actually own guns, explicitly be able to attack the government whenever they deem it necessary. It's reasonable to assume that someone in this culture might take her literally, which is why her rhetoric is violent and yours is not, even if you metaphorically refer to violence. That's a great point. When I say hold Obama's feet to the fire, I don't really... you would have to... a reasonable person could not conclude that anybody could actually take that message and actually do it. Doesn't there seem to be an eerie similarity between AAR pushing Randy out and MSNBC pushing Keith out? That's what I said. I mean, wouldn't it be impossible to imagine there's not going to be a huge boner for... this is not going to be a huge boner for MSNBC? I don't see how they get more ratings. I do not see how they increase their ratings with this move. I can't imagine that they're sitting there thinking this is going to increase ratings. I think they think this is going to maintain ratings at best. Now, is it possible that Ed would be a bigger success at 10 p.m. than Lawrence O'Donnell? I think he could be as good as O'Donnell there in terms of ratings, you know, just completely, just generically speaking. But I just don't know if there's that many more people who are going to watch at 10 p.m. You know, that's just, you know, O'Donnell was almost, you know, was hanging in there with Rachel's numbers. You know, maybe some drop off, but that's to be expected because it's 10 p.m. at night. is O'Donnell going to have a bigger audience at 8 p.m. than Olbermann? I find that very hard to believe. I mean, I guess it's possible. I don't know who those people would show up, though. I mean, I guess that there are people who, if he keeps all of Keith's audience, and there are people who are like Matthews, they might be more inclined to like O'Donnell than Olbermann. You know, maybe, but I don't see it. I don't see how they, maybe, but I can imagine a scenario where O'Donnell maybe does marginally better than Olbermann did. Marginally. But that would have to be that he loses none of the audience, and I find that hard to believe. And I don't see how this helps Rachel's numbers. You know, I mean, Rachel was literally built out of Keith's... Rachel was, you know, it's basically as close as you can get to a spinoff. It's like... market there. It's not Name Drop Friday, Sam. Did I name drop today? I don't think I name dropped, did I?
I lose track.
Because I was talking about O'Donnell, and that's not really name drop, is it? I don't think that's name drop. Was it because I mentioned that my father IM'd me? Texted me? Was that what that was the name? Don't be a putz. Corporate news emphasizes issue where the Dems and Republicans disagree. You get it right, but never discusses issues where they are in 100% agreement. Pro-war, pro-Israel, pro-corporation, pro-rich people. That's a good point. Hypothetical for you. If Obama, Palin ran on one ticket with a platform of all the issues which they agree to, pro-war, pro-corporate, and Kucinich, Ron Paul ran on the other ticket with a platform of all their common issues, anti-war, anti-corporate, who would you vote for? Well, I would vote for Kucinich and Ron Paul. I thought that question was going to be harder. Comments on Obama's appointment of GE CEO Jeff Immelt. How much corporate cock does this guy have to suck before he realizes he's playing for the other team? First of all, I think you are mischaracterizing. What's the other team? I think you're mischaracterizing my perception of Obama. But yes, replacing Volcker with replacing the guy who wanted to really put restrictions on these financial institutions with the guy who ran one. Because, you know, GE financing was one of the ones that really fucked things up. Goldman Sachs, GMAC, and GE had had basically a shadow bank worth something like $600 billion. And they set up these shadow banks because they don't fall under the same regulation. And he's still the CEO. Right. I mean, I don't know where you've been, but have I not been stressing that I think Obama is a corporatist in this way and that he is? Have I not? Is that not clear to people? I don't know why you had to make a sexual. Don't be a putz. After party, post show, says Avant, you should put out a poll thread on the Majority FM and get feedback. Yeah. That's a good point. Let's put up a very small, you know, like, do it more. Like, put all the comments on the next page. You know what I mean? Give us suggestions for majority.fm. Oh, you also did you see the Wibia toolbar at the bottom?
No.
What? Mm-mm. Should be up. Majority FM.
I think that was because I was an admin.
I put up a toolbar. Check it out, folks. Very cool. We're just playing around with it. You see it?
I don't see it.
Shit, I didn't do it right.
Maybe it's because we're in
Chrome. Oh, wait. It loaded up.
No, there it is.
Okay. It takes a second to
load.
I see the chat room.
Put your I like Newtoba. You can watch the Sammy Cam and chat on the site at the same time. It's just that your factions are spread from Sam Cedar Show, Ustream. Yeah, we need to come together in one spot. Yes, you're right. You're right. You're right, Avant. And we're going to do that. They should join in the chat room. People are already using the chat. But we'll set up a post and give us your suggestions for what to call the members-only post show. It's amusing to watch the right cackle of glee about Oldman. Oldman left because he spoke his mind against corporate management, where Beck and Hannity spew the crap that management want the public to hear. Trip, my Super Bowl. What are we now on? 25? Plan, pretend I'm Jewish and it's Christmas. Chinese in a movie. I think KO and Rachel are more dedicated to facts and sourcing like Cedar than Fat Eddie, Oops, and O'Donnell, who are more like righty talkers, boobleheads. They are mostly unimpeachable and apologize when in error. Well, I appreciate the company you've put me in. Olbermann off TV for 6 to 9 months. Can't discuss departure from MSNBC report. That's on Raw Story, so there you have it. I don't know if that's true, but that sounds right to me. As a liberal trying to survive out here in Redland Mania, Keith was essential to my sanity, easy to feel isolated and voiceless. When those senator, representative bring my politics and values, Keith spoke for me. Don't want to be corny, but I'm sincerely glad your voice is back. Oh, well, thank you, Susan. I appreciate that. Joe Mentum, your I Am conversation with Joe. I'm glad Oberman Bastard's finally gone. He never appreciated my brilliance, and Hadassah hates him. Crystal Crown. Wherever he goes, I hope Keith considers a less teleprompted format. Even you and Zank, who I can listen to for hours a day on your own shows, are less listenable on TV because of the strange sort of numbing effect teleprompting has. Lewis Lapham talks about wanting to hear the sound of a human voice in journalism. The pacing and quick jump of TV leaves little room. Amy Goodman mixes both. Keith could follow that. If only the usual lineup of MSNBC throw-to sources would be replaced instead. Jonathan Alter, Gene Robinson, Richard Wolff. It couldn't be better at status quoing. Any issue, it's also Oldman who helped get people like you and Rachel on TV who will do that now. It's a good point. All of that's a good point. All of it. I don't know. Just got missed up most of the show, but thanks for positive spin on KO. I felt about him like I feel about you. Everything stops for me. A countdown, just like the old MMR. In fact, I didn't start watching KO until MMR was killed. Also, did anyone here broach the idea of KO as new White House press secretary? No, I don't think so. Katrina V had picked up on my tweet about White House press secretary Friday night. Ratings, does this mean no TV for me until 9 p.m. for Rachel? I have the toolbar. Yeah, there you go. Taurus E80. Melanie Sloan has decided to remain at the helm of Watchdog Group for Crew, reversing her earlier decision to join Clinton administration Lanny Davis in a private law firm. Interesting. Ah, I got to say, though, I have much... she has seriously, seriously damaged her brand and Crew's, frankly. Wow. There's a greater threat of being killed by right-wing Christian terrorists than by Muslim terrorists in the United States. I don't know if that's true. Numerically. Maybe in terms of incidents. Majority Fuller, how long does it take Bill O'Reilly to take credit for forcing Oberman off the air? He'll be very humble about it. If Marin gives you his microphone, you have to call it the Marin, a la the Sinclair, in which case Marin would win. But he's doing it anonymously, so I don't have to do that. On the subject of the media overhyping the threat of Islamic terrorists, do you really think that B.J. Reynolds' anti-smoking campaign is disingenuous, Sam? You probably do, don't you? God, you're so cynical. Jan Scapin, do you think Maddow expected Olbermann's to get Olbermann's time slot? No. Hadn't even occurred to me, but no. Look, she's having success where she is now, and I think her time slot is sort of perfectly made for her. That's why I think, like, it'll be interesting to see if O'Donnell changes his show. Because I do think his show was like a sort of a slower paced, more, you know, not headline of the day type of show, per se. And he's going to have to change that if he's doing APM. I don't think Rachel thought that. But you know, I have no insight into that. MSNBC, they did the same thing with Donahue many years ago. Well, the difference is that Donahue was paid a lot more money than I think could be sustained at MSNBC at that time, because he was the highest rated. But you know who they had, I think, following Donahue at that time? The Jerry Nachman Show. I'm not sure if, absolutely, but I'm pretty sure that show was floating around. Do you know who Jerry Nachman is? I don't know either. I think he was like the head of the Post or Daily News, or I think he was a good reporter. He was just sort of this heavyset guy who wore like a fedora and a typewriter, and I think he was running the MSNBC. I mean, it's not the equivalent. Immelt is only a corporatist, but actually a self-described Republican. Right. No, I hear you. I mean, you know, it's an economic advisory council. Or not even that, but... I agree with any issues with Obama. Oh, I name dropped Busey. Boy, I never thought about that as a name drop. All right, folks. Went over today. Shouldn't have done it. Somebody's got to crack the whip. See you tomorrow. Just a house cleaning. On Wednesday, Eric Alterman will be on the program. You don't want to miss that, because Alterman and I always have a very fun time with each other. He's historically been one of the most difficult guests on the Majority Report. Longtime Majority Report listeners will remember the time that we were at the Aspen Comedy Festival and he actually sent back a drink while on air because it didn't have the proper lemon in it. And we'll be talking about his new book, Kabuki Democracy. Tomorrow we will be, prepping you for the State of the Union a little bit and going over some stories. Hopefully the State of the Union will be boring and uneventful. That's my hope. That's the best case scenario. All right, folks. Till tomorrow. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the man